I got into the car with a drunk driver. I don't really remember much, but I do remember waking up with the car on its side and just hurting. I mean, I'd hurt my neck, I'd hurt my back. The worst part was my leg was shattered. I really didn't know what to feel. I knew that I'd gotten in the car with the drunk driver. That felt like that was my mistake, but I wasn't the one driving and I wasn't the one that caused the accident, so I really wasn't sure how to feel. I talked to my mom and she ended up recommending just calling the advocates. Even though it was complicated and I felt like maybe I'd made a mistake or I felt guilty, there was zero judgment from them. I felt like they were always on my side and they were always doing what was best for me. Really, it gave me my life back. I was able to stop replaying all the decisions I made and I was able to just move forward and really start rebuilding my life because the advocates really took care of everything.
I'm Matt with the Advocates Injury Lawyers. If guilt is keeping you from getting help, just call us. We'll represent you and remind you that you deserve justice.
We believe in a religion that emphasizes the importance of verification and it emphasizes the importance of following knowledge and not following things that are uncertain. Like, we pursue truth, we pursue certainty. That's part of the core DNA of Islam, right? We don't just believe in something because it feels good to believe in it. And we don't believe in something because our parents told us to believe in it. That's actually the Quran's criticism of other religions, that they're not based on reason and the pursuit of truth. If you were to boil down the pursuits in our religion, they just boil down to two things. The pursuit of truth and the pursuit of justice. That's it. Those are the two pursuits. And the ultimate truth is Allah in that sense too, right? So you'll find the legacies of the prophets, all the debates that are mentioned in the Quran, all their struggles that are mentioned in the Quran boil down to those two things. The pursuit of truth and the pursuit of justice. The Quran criticizes two key groups of people. One group of people that were engaged in injustices. They're, you know, unjust to the orphan or unjust to, you know, innocent people. They kill unjustly, they steal unjustly, they violate the rights of the weak, etc., etc. That's injustice. That's the battle against injustice. And then there are people that spread falsehood. It's a battle for truth. It's the pursuit of truth. And within that pursuit of truth, the Quran even comes after people that claim to be people of knowledge, like the rabbis, right? They had knowledge, but they were using their legitimacy, their titles, to bend the truth to what served their interests. So Allah even exposed that people that claim some sort of copyright or some kind of license to the truth can actually become corrupt also, that they can use it for whatever other means, political means and other sorts of means. Our history, Muslim history, is not immune from these problems. We don't have a glorious, cleansed, detoxed history. We have a difficult history. And there are people who made up stories about our religion. And then they popularized those stories. That happened, right? And then the problem is when we, over time, became passive as a civilization, we became passive Muslims. So you've heard certain stories growing up, and that's your Islam. Your Islam is based on these stories that you've heard your whole life. And then someone comes along and says, actually, that's not a real thing. That's not legit, etc. You're like, this is what I'm... You think my parents, my villager, my grand, you know, my the biggest beard uncle I know told me this story. How can it be wrong, etc., etc.? We have this idea of appeal to authority. Who are you to question something when someone so much older than you or someone so much more credentialed than you didn't question it? The problem isn't, truth doesn't come from an age. Truth doesn't come from a person. Truth comes from evidence, right? So you have to follow the evidence. You have to follow to the source. And we apply this in every other situation except for our religion, unfortunately, right? So Muslims became far more interested in, I'm just gonna not think about something and just take it for what it is and not question it. I'm not telling you to question everything and become a skeptic. However, there are things that you don't have a choice but to challenge it. Because your fitrah goes against it. The Quran goes against it. The legacy of our Prophet goes against it. And there's going to be things like that are sometimes even mentioned in our books. There are things that are problematic that are mentioned in our books. That's a fact. You can't get around it. You know? Not too long ago, we were studying Surah Al-Qalam. And Noon wal-Qalami wa ma yasturun. Right? And Noon is one of the letters that is not translated. It's just Allah said noon, right? So the Sahaba, many of them had opinions about what noon means. And one of the suggested meanings of noon from some of the companions of the Prophet ﷺ was that it's a giant whale in the sky, a whale in space. And on the fin of that whale, the earth is spinning. Right? That's an opinion found in classical tafsir. Now, do we accept that opinion? Some people went as far in their loyalty to, well, if the Sahabi said it, they must have got it from somewhere, so there must be an invisible whale in space. And now you can find YouTube videos of Muslims who believe in whales in space and the atheists make fun of it and all that kind of stuff. Well, here's what's actually going on. One, no, that's not what noon means. Two, the Sahaba weren't necessarily telling you that's what noon means. They were saying, I tried to find out what it means. I asked around. The only thing I came across is this story about noon. That's all I've ever heard. But I still don't know what it means. But just because they're citing this thing about noon doesn't mean that's what they believe. That means that's all they found when they asked around. Meaning they were explorers themselves. They weren't just taking something and saying, I don't know. This is telling you that the legacy of the prophets of the Sahaba radiallahu anhum ajma'in was actually exploration. They were thinking about the word of Allah and trying to find out what it means. Actually, that whole story about a whale and the fin, that's from Jewish tradition. And there were Jewish tribes in the area, and that story was floating around about what that noon might mean. So what I'm saying is history is more complex than I just found it in a book. There's more going on. And we are supposed to be a sophisticated civilization. We're supposed to be thinking more deeply and more critically. There's two extremes now. Either if I found it in a book written by somebody, some sheikh, somebody I consider like the Catholics have the Pope. We have popified figures in Islam too. So if they said it, khalas, that's the end of it, right? There's that level of loyalty to the scholar. Or there is, forget about the scholarship. They talked about a whale. Who needs scholarship, right? There's these two extremes. Either throw out the whole kitchen sink or take the whole thing. No, we're not here to accept or reject people. The pursuit of truth means you're accepting or rejecting evidence one case at a time, one situation at a time, one investigation at a time. The same scholar may have said something ingenious in some things, and absolutely verifiable in some things, and may have not done a great job in some other things. And we can't not benefit from the good that they did, because we found something. And you know, this new psychosis that Muslims have developed. Oh, I found the sheikh, he made a mistake. I don't understand this psychological disorder. You found a human being who made a mistake? Congratulations to you. Really happy for you. Now that I found that they made a mistake, you can't listen to anything they ever say. Well, thank Allah, the person who's saying it has never made a mistake, which is why we should listen to everything they always say. Right? Because they crossed the threshold for not making mistakes. They have immunity. They took a vaccine. They have a khata vaccine. Right? They took that. Everybody else, they can find the mistakes of except themselves. Allah. This is what happens when we become obsessed with personalities as opposed to obsessed with the argument, with the evidence. And so what I'm saying here in the first historical analysis based on reliable reports is what I mean. We have to take a critical look at history. We have to take a critical look at the evidence that we have and how reliable it is and where does it originate from and how far back can we take it. And if it's not 100% and if it's 70%, we should be comfortable saying, hey, that's 70%. You know, we can't be entirely sure. So how does that impact our understanding of the Quran? Here's how it impacts it. The Quran is absolute. The Quran is the explicit word of Allah. It's spelled out. And then you have some reports that may not be as reliable. You cannot take the stuff that's not as reliable and use it to override the meaning of that which is qat'i. You cannot take the dhanni, the implicit, and override the explicit. You understand? And that's what often we do. We often take the words of the Quran and we take a report, and the report is not the strongest evidence, and we start imposing it onto the ayah when the ayah isn't saying that. But we're going to engage in that journey. I'm setting that stage. I'm preparing you for the stuff that's coming, right? Because that's one of the grunt works, so one of the difficult tasks we're going to have to engage in. Anyway, so the second is the development of who is an-Nabi alayhi salatu wasalam to us. This is going to be a development. Like, what we feel about the Prophet in the beginning of the surah and how our feelings towards him and our understanding of him evolves and changes. It's actually, he also is undergoing a kind of special training in this surah because he's being tested, alayhi salatu wasalam, in unique ways that he has not been tested before. And it's crazy to say, right? Rasulullah has been tested in so many ways. You would think, almost towards the end of the seerah of the Prophet ﷺ, this is now fifth or nearly the sixth year of the migration, right? So if you count it, it's about 18 out of the 23 years of revelation are practically gone. 18 out of 23. You would think the big tests are all over. No, no, no. Some of the toughest tests are just now. After all of that, now we're landing there. So, and then of course, there are going to be different elements in this surah. I could have given you an overview of all the subjects in this surah. I haven't. But we're going to see different elements and we're going to make sure we understand how each of those elements are actually, they look separate, but they're working together. I've read non-Muslim literature, Orientalist literature on this surah. There are people who claim that the Quran is an incoherent text. What that means is the Quran's surahs or chapters, they're not quite chapters, they don't make any logical sense. They're all over the place. Right? They don't come together. The subject keeps moving and shifting and things like that. There's no chapter-like organization in the Quran. And the number one surah they quote to claim that the Quran is incoherent and doesn't have any structural integrity or flow, logical flow, is Surah Al-Ahzab. They use this as the case they make for the incoherence of the Quran. We're going to look at Surah Al-Ahzab as a case of the remarkable coherence of the Quran. We're going to do the opposite. We're going to look at how beautifully things are tied together in a way only Allah can do. Human beings can't. Okay. And finally, we're going to look at certain anchors and the connections to previous revelations. What that means is there are certain key terms in this surah, and we're going to see how those key terms were used in surahs that were revealed before this surah, and how they're also, those terms are reaching a climax as they approach this surah. Okay, so that's our four-step process. You'll see it throughout the month, inshallah. Now, I want to share something with you. I don't just want to give you lectures about the surah. I want to give you certain things that even beyond the study that you're going to do with me this month, in your own study of the Quran, in your own exploration of the Quran, there are some things I want you to become mindful of. I want you to have certain tools that'll help you think about the Quran better and more effectively. And so one part of the Quran is when Allah is commenting on an event in the Prophet's life, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. There's different pieces of the Quran, right? There's oaths in the Quran and parables in the Quran and stories in the Quran and laws in the Quran, etc., etc. There's all these different components. One component is Allah is talking about an event in the seerah, in the Prophet's life, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. When you get to a place in the Quran when Allah is talking about one of the events in his life, then here's a suggested process. First, understand the historical event. So in this case, I told you there are four historical events. We're going to try to understand them, right? But first, you don't even look at the ayah. You're just trying to understand the historical event. What happened? Then you're going to look at the revelation, the Quran, as a commentary on that event. And let me pause here and help you understand what I mean by that. It's actually pretty deep. I'm having too much fun though. I'm jealous. Okay. So here's what I mean. Let's just say there's news about what, Trump tweeted today or something. Or there's news from Ukraine. Or there's news from the United Nations. Something. There's some news event. The news spread. But there's one expert that you trust. There's an analyst, there's a scholar, there's a researcher, there's a geopolitical thinker, et cetera, et cetera. You're like, okay, everybody's talking about this event, but I don't want to hear from a 14-year-old what they think and a TikToker. I want to go to this expert. I want to get their opinion on how do I understand this event? Everybody knows the event happened, but that analyst, that thinker, that intellectual, they will give you a perspective nobody else could give you because they have a deeper understanding of the politics, the economic undercurrents, the social, et cetera, et cetera. You understand? I have, certain friends that work in certain governments in higher levels, right? And something's going on in that country. And I watch the news and I'm like, what's going on? And I call them and say, no, that's not what's going on. Let me tell you what's going on. Because I was in the meeting with the generals and this is what they were talking about, etc. I was like, oh, okay, yeah. The news tells you one thing, But the people on the inside have a different story. You understand? So there's this the idea of expert opinion on something, right? Even if it's the same event, do we all understand the same event the same way? No, we don't. That depends on our level of knowledge, our level of understanding. Now think about this. There's an event that happened in the Prophet's life. Who's about to comment on it? Allah is going to comment on it. Allah is going to reveal certain ayat talking about that event. In other words, it's not that we have to understand the ayat better by understanding the event. No, you can't understand the event unless you understand Allah's ayat. Allah's ayat are the commentary on how to understand that event. So what we've done is we've reverse engineered this, and what we've done is let's understand the ayat by understanding the event. What I'm saying is, let's understand the event by understanding the ayat. The ayat are going to highlight the event in a way that no historian could highlight it. Not even the people that experienced it could highlight it. They couldn't figure out what's going on. Only Allah could. Only Allah could. I'll give you an easy example of that. And it'll come in handy for this surah too. It's Suratul Fath. When Hudaybiyah was signed, thousands of companions, you know, hundreds, if not in the thousands of the companions, were frustrated when the treaty was signed. They all witnessed the same event. They're all upset. They all see this as a loss. They're all angry. All of them, not with no exceptions. Everybody's upset. And the Quran comments on the same event. And the Quran comments and says, "Inna fatahna laka fatha mubina." We've given you an unequivocal, undisputed, open victory. Before that ayah came, and the ayah came right after the signing, soon after the signing, when they're basically taking their walk of shame back to Medina. In the sense, that's how the Sahaba are feeling. It's a walk of shame. We came here to do Hajj, we couldn't even do Hajj. And Allah is revealing, we have given you the most open victory. There's no ayah in the Quran that describes victory in more explicit terms than Surah Al-Fath. But it doesn't look like victory to anybody. It looks like loss. It looks like humiliation. How is this victory? The Quran commented on something that no human being could understand the reality of. Only Allah could. Now understand what Allah means when He says that the Quran is light. What is the function of light? Light helps me identify the reality of an object. If there was no lights on in here and it was pitch black outside, I don't know how far something is. I don't know how big something is. I don't know if there's a snake in front of me or a child in front of me. I don't know the reality around me in the absence of light. The Quran calls itself what? Light. What that means is, the Quran is a means by which we can understand the reality of something. So when there's a seerah event, and then the ayat come, the ayat are putting a light on that event that no history report can put. No other document can put. And so that's the ultimate lens by which to understand the event. That's the ultimate lens. Now what we've done is, because we reverse engineered it, we're like, let's shed light on the ayat by these reports. Right? How are you going to shed light on light? Light sheds itself on everything else. It's not the other way around. And this has bad consequences. In our understanding, we start getting gaps in our understanding because of that. So what I'm saying is, what's your process? First, just look at the reports. First, look at what are the historians saying. Then look at how is the Quran shedding light on this? How is the Quran talking about this event? But then there's the third. Now that the Quran talked about it, you have to ask yourself a really hard question. What am I supposed to learn from this? Okay, so there's this thing that happened, and then we know Allah talked about it. I get it. And this is how Allah talked about it. But in the end, the goal of all of it is my guidance. Your guidance. That's the third step. What are the universal principles? What are the guidance? What am I getting from this that I'm supposed to take? What's my take home? What's my takeaway? Because the takeaway cannot just be interesting information. The takeaway cannot just be, I learned a lot about history. That can't be the takeaway. We're going to go through a lot of history this month. We're going to go through a lot of ayat, a lot of tafsir, a lot of, you know, commentary. That's a lot of information. But that's not the takeaway. All that hard work, so we get the best takeaway we can. If you don't do this step three, you missed the whole... You cooked everything, you didn't eat it. Right? You got no nutrition out of it. It's delicious food, but you didn't consume it. Right? So this is the ultimate objective. The third piece is the ultimate objective. And in one way, you can say that one and two are tafsir, and three is tadabbur. That's another way to think about it. One and two is the study, and three is, well, what does this study mean for us? That's contemplation. That's contemplation. Because we're supposed to study the Quran, and we're supposed to contemplate the Quran. Okay? So this is a process that I want you to become familiar with. Now we're going to talk a little bit about the controversial marriage and why this controversial marriage of the Prophet ﷺ to Zainab radiallahu anha, our mother, is at the center of the surah, and how we will see that this is a huge gift of Allah to this ummah, this marriage. And he was married to, you know, in his lifetime, 11 women, 11 mothers of the believers, right? But this one marriage is a special gift of Allah, recorded in the Quran for this ummah, and we're going to see why. So everybody's looking at it as controversy, right? And the Quran is going to take something that's controversial, and what's he going to turn it into? A blessing. He's going to reverse, and like it's light that without Allah's light, we wouldn't have seen it. You ever seen those UV rays or lights that you shine on them, and now you could see things you didn't see before? Or X-ray vision? That's what the Quran's going to do. So even though I'm using the word controversial marriage from the shallow lens. But by the time we're done looking at it from the Quran's lens, it's going to be the blessed marriage. It's going to be something else entirely. And then we're going to be ready to take something away from it that's going to illuminate our lives, right? So it's repeated in the very beginning in ayah number 4, in the middle between 36 to 38, and at the end towards, because it's 73 ayat of the surah, it's all the way at the end in ayah number 69 also. And there's some references to it in 58 and 60. And what's interesting is I mentioned there are four major events, right, that are in this surah. And this reference comes up in the neighborhood of each of those events. Like there's the reference to this, and then another incident, another historical event. Then a reference to this, then another incident. So all the other events in the surah are kind of circling around the marriage of Zainab radiallahu anha to our Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. So this is kind of like the tie-in to all of them, is what's happening. Okay. Now we have to understand something about the history, the backdrop of the surah, and I'm going to lay some things out for you before I show you the next slide. Badr was our first military victory. Everybody knows that. Uhud was a pretty devastating loss. Right? The Prophet himself, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, was almost killed. This was won, of course, in part because of the treachery of the munafiqun, the hypocrites. But this also had other consequences. It emboldened people to question the leadership of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, because if he's the Prophet guaranteed victory from Allah, how could he lose? Right? How could he lose? And because we were confused by, we're following the Prophet of Allah and we lost, and the Prophet himself was almost killed. What kind of, he was almost, how can he be the Prophet of Allah and he's almost killed? Right? So what did Allah do? Allah revealed almost 60 ayat of Surah Ali Imran, Surah number 3, to help us understand Uhud. Just to process Uhud. Uhud, the commentary on how to make sense of Uhud after it happened was given to the Prophet ﷺ in Ali Imran, after the Battle of Uhud. Okay? Now, even though, now that we lost, let's understand the geopolitical climate. The Quraysh got their revenge. Because they lost in Badr, and now they got their revenge. Not only did they get their revenge, they're a little bit fired up. They're like, man, we got them. And they're down right now. They're injured. This is a good opportunity. We need to strike back and finish the job. But we know, even if we win, we're not going to be able to finish them off. We need more than that. Ka'ab ibn Ashraf, on the other side, the Prophet ﷺ had treaties with Jewish tribes, right? And some of those Jewish tribes, they were treacherous against the Prophet ﷺ. They broke their treaties. And some of those tribes got expelled in the meantime from Medina. And some of those tribes vowed revenge against the Prophet ﷺ. So after Uhud, not only are the Quraysh emboldened, they're like, we should come back and fight more. The Jewish tribes that are in the proximity of Medina are now going around trying to rally everybody and say, look, This is a problem for you guys. It's also a problem for us. This Islam thing is spread like a virus in Medina. We need to end this problem. So you guys come from the outside. We'll take care of business from the inside. And it's going to be easy money. Let's just kill all these people and take all their lands, all their homes, enslave their, you know, women and children, whatever we got to do. We'll just take all of it. And if the two of us are not enough, let's convince other tribes that this is going to be easy money, easy victory. Let's get us all together, which is Al-Ahzab, the different groups, different tribes, all thinking this is going to be an easy victory because we're all together. And now these legions of, you know, tens of thousands are coming for the city of Medina. This is not a battle that's going to happen on the battlefield. It's going to happen inside the city. So this is civilian warfare. It's not battlefield warfare. They are completely okay with killing civilians. Badr and Uhud were on a battlefield. This is going to be inside the city of Medina. Right? So they're, and the enemy is now okay with killing civilians, which is a lesson by itself. Right? And it's not one of them that's okay with the killing of civilians. Ahzab, groups of them, are okay with the killing of civilians because they each see some level of economic benefit for themselves. They're not even ideologically interested in killing the Muslims. They're just interested in killing the Muslims because it's going to bring them easy money. Sound familiar? Right? And they're all completely okay with it together. And so they come as an onslaught against the Muslims. Now, the only thing Muslims can do is dig a trench, by one Sahabi's suggestion, to keep them from entering the city and basically creating rampage and mass murder, right? So all the Muslims can do is survive this wave. And of course they do, alhamdulillah, right? By Allah's permission, Allah's going to comment on that in the surah, this final attack failed. Now I want you to understand this failure and why this failure is so crucial from the Quraysh's perspective. The Quraysh are the big dog. They're the US of the time. Okay? If the US, if the Quraysh come and attack, other people might get more brave and join. Now that they couldn't get far, they lost, or they didn't win, rather. It's expensive to come out and bring your military. It's expensive to pay for your military convoys, their food, their supplies, their water, their animals, right? Their upkeep, their housing, and all of it. And tending to the sick, because they're all camped out in the desert outside Medina. It's a campgrounds. So they have to build an entire base and stay there for weeks and weeks and weeks on end. It gets more and more and more expensive. And all those tribes that joined, they joined because it's going to be easy money. So it's going to get a good return on investment. But now they're losing money by the day, and there's no return on investment. They're losing all this cash, and eventually winds come and campfires turn over, animals die, and food gets destroyed, and sickness spreads, and they're like, oh, it's, you know what, forget it, I'm out of here. One by one, the tribes, some of the tribes that were coming in for easy money, they start slipping away. This wasn't worth it. This was a bad idea. This was a bad investment. Eventually, Quraysh pulls back too. They can't hold on to the siege. When they pull back, it's not the small tribes that lose credibility. Who actually loses credibility? Quraysh. And the Quraysh now know the next time they ask, hey, let's get together and kill Muslims, people aren't going to, yeah, we did that already, thanks. We're not doing that with you again. That already cost us a lot of money, and it was a big waste of time. No, thank you. We're done with that. So now they don't have the kind of clout and the kind of influence that they had before this humiliating loss. This is the nature of big powers. When big powers make a move and they influence smaller powers to join them, but when they fail in the mission, then they lose credibility across the board. Sound familiar? there's some very universal political science things that are happening in the Sira that you see around you all the time, right? So that sounds dangerous. Yeah, anyway. What's happening on the inside? Well, as soon as they leave and Medina is secure, the Prophet ﷺ says, well, they're the enemy on the outside, but we have an enemy right next door, Banu Qurayza, the Jewish tribe that was conspiring with the Meccans to attack, stab us in the back. So within days, there's the incident of Banu Qurayza, which is going to be mentioned in this surah also. Right? It's one of the controversial incidents in the seerah of the Prophet ﷺ. We're going to deal with that incident also when it comes, because they claim it was a genocide. that thousands of, you know, people were killed in one day, you know, like literally slaughtered in one day. We're going to explore the historicity of that when the time comes. But regardless, Banu Qurayda, very wealthy tribe, has now been defeated and their assets seized because they violated the treaty against the Muslims. Now Muslims are starting to come into a lot of money for the first time. Remember, in Badr and Uhud, we were starving, but now money is starting to come in. So now Muslims, for the first time, the Quraysh have been weakened and the Muslims have been strengthened. So the things are politically changing in the region. Within the next year or so, 7-8 months to a year, there's going to be the Treaty of Hudaybiyah. These are the 7-8 months before the Treaty of Hudaybiyah. So things are already, the tide is already turning in favor of the Muslims, so much so that they're bold enough that they're going to go and attempt to make Hajj. Because Hudaybiyah is an attempt to make Hajj, right? The thing is, not a year ago, you couldn't even leave your city because they had camp right outside your city to kill all of you. But now you're not even staying in your city. You're going to the wild animals that came to kill you. You're going to them. And you don't go to Hajj armed to the teeth. You go to Hajj basically only with the dagger that you're going to slaughter your animal with. Basically, you go to the Hajj essentially unarmed. And they're going to go. If there was ever a time to kill all the Muslims easily, it would be when they went for Hajj. Right? The fact that they go in large number, they don't go in small number. When they go in that large number, all the other tribes see that these Muslims are going to do Hajj unarmed like that to Mecca. Oh, he's serious, man. Wow, that's a show of strength. Everybody's thinking they're going to come back dead. Their dead bodies are going to return. بَلْ ظَنَنْتُمْ أَنَّ لَنْ يَنْقَلِبَ الرَّسُولُ وَالْمُؤْمِنُونَ إِلَىٰ أَهْلِهِمْ أَبَدًا وَزُّيِّنَ ذَلِكَ فِي قُلُوبِكُمْ وَظَنَنْتُمْ ظَنَّ السَّوْءِ وَكُنْتُمْ قَوْمًا بُورًا. Surah Al-Fatih even describes this. The hypocrites in Medina were convinced that when you leave for Hajj, you ain't coming back. You're all going to die. And they love the idea that they're just going to die off. وَزُّيِّنَ ذَلِكَ فِي قُلُوبِكُمْ. The thought of that was really good, beautiful in your minds. You thought it was a lovely idea that we didn't have to kill them. They're going to go get themselves killed. When they come back unscathed back to Medina, what message does it send to all of the region? Muslims are untouchable. They went into the lion's den, opened the lion's mouth, looked inside, and came back. They have basically won the region politically, as far as influence, without ever using any military tactic. Hudaybiyah is a statement that Quraysh have no teeth. All bark and no bite. So even though the Muslims thought it was a loss, it was actually a massive victory. You understand? But that victory, the process of that victory began with the Battle of the Trench. It began with that battle. Okay. Now, let's look at this landscape. We're still talking about before Hudaybiyah still. By this time, the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ was unquestionably one of the most powerful figures in the Hijaz. Unlike the earlier defensive postures, Badr, Uhud, Khandaq, all of them were defensive, basically. The Muslims began to project power proactively, launching expeditions with the express intent of engaging the enemy and consolidating authority. In other words, other than attacking Mecca, we went after everybody else. We started consolidating power, expanding our region, expanding our territory and zones. There were some key military objectives. Number one, to enrich the Muslims, enrich the state. Now we have to have a treasury. Because barely, you know, there were times that, you know, in the seerah of the Prophet ﷺ, Fatima radiallahu anha comes to the Prophet ﷺ and says, I haven't eaten for 2 days, 3 days. And he lifts his shirt and he's got stones tied to his belly. You guys know the story, right? This is not that time. Now it's time to fill the coffers of the Muslims, the vaults of the Muslims with wealth, and build the treasury of the Muslims, and build a massive military enterprise. This is a completely different situation now after Ahzab. So the Sariya of Zayd ibn Haritha, and then the, you know, where they intercepted and captured an entire Quraysh caravan returning from Syria. Remember Rihlat al-Shita'i wa-Saif? That the easy caravans that the Quraysh used to take, that nobody used to touch, well, the Muslims touched them. And Syria means the When the caravan is coming from Syria, it means it's bringing goods from all across Europe and the Levant, the entire Roman Empire. They import goods. The trading port is Syria. And from Syria, they bring it back and they're going to go sell it in Yemen, from where it's going to go into the marketplace in Africa and India and other places. So they're the pipeline. So they have all these expensive goods coming from the Roman Empire and from other parts of the, you know, the West. And the Muslims capture all those goods. Elite goods. Import brand stuff, right? Now this starts helping fund the Muslims in ways they've never seen before. Now there's a buffer zone. They have a regional control. Now the Quraysh know that their caravans are going to get caught. So they don't go into certain territories where they used to move freely. So you've limited the movements of the Quraysh also in the region, right? And now, you know how they came right to Medina and there had to be a trench? But now there's a perimeter around Medina. You can't even get close to Medina anymore for the kuffar, for the enemies. So our sphere of influence has expanded. This is important also. There were people that were financing the campaign against the Muslims, conspiring against the Muslims. The Prophet ﷺ instructed specific assassinations of key enemies. You know, they call them targeted assassinations, drone strikes, right? So the covert operations, strike teams, infiltrations, those kinds of objectives. We were in a state where the entire city was about to be killed. That was all defense. This is not defense anymore. This is what? This is offense. You're debilitating your enemy. You're taking out key enemy targets, right? And then 4, retaliation against aggressors. Anybody who came at us that were medium to small size, we went after them. And, you know, there are people that had massacred Muslims and others. Now people know, don't mess with Muslims. You're going to pay the price. Now in the region, there's an actual intimidation of Muslim military might. And all of this is happening very, very quickly. Because remember, the Battle of the Trench happens. And within a year, we're going to be maybe a little more, a little less, but that's basically when we're going to be in Hudaybiyah. And all of this is happening before Hudaybiyah. So things are changing for the Muslims very quickly. The 3 battles of Islam before this, Badr, Uhud, and Ahzab, all 3 of them, we barely survived. Barely. But we had almost nothing in Badr. We took devastating losses in Uhud. And we got almost genocided in Ahzab. Right? But this is a completely different military landscape. So this is one thing you need to understand about when this surah was revealed. We were already coming into a position of power. There are many surahs of the Quran where Muslims are in a position of weakness and the revelation comes. Suratul Ahzab is not coming when Muslims are in a position of weakness. Suratul Ahzab is coming, we're in a position of strength. We're in a position of strength. Okay. The Quraysh's hostility remained potent. Still, even though we were winning, they're still our enemies. The Khaybar's Jews, Banu Nadir, Banu Qaynuqa, they also started joining forces, and they still represent a threat against the Muslims. But now we are in a different stage. We used to be in a survival stage. We are now in an internal stabilization stage. And at the same time, the community is being consolidated. Revelations are coming about family life, how to be in the home, the dress code, food regulations, Hajj rituals. These revelations are starting to come that are the formulation of a community. This is not discussions about survival in a military setting. This is about the beginnings of a civilization now. It's as if the foundation has been laid. Now it's time to set up this community. And those kinds of revelations are starting to come in the Quran. So what we need to talk about now is when Muslims are coming into power, the enemy sees that the only thing we can do now is to sow some kind of doubt and confusion and discord within them. I was telling you, demoralize the Muslim. And the easy target for that was the marriage that was happening, or that happened with Zainab radiallahu ta'ala anha. We're not clear about when exactly it happened. We do know it happened around Ahzab, right at Ahzab, maybe right before Ahzab or right after Ahzab. It's something there in that time that this marriage happened, right? But it's by the time the surah comes, the marriage is already done. It's already happened. And Allah is commenting on something that's already taken place. Because we know that, what it seems to suggest is that people were already talking. There was a lot of rumor. There was a lot of criticism and controversy, etc., about what just happened here. And in just to understand the brief outline of the story, because you should know the basic outline of the story, the Prophet ﷺ had, I'm not going to use the word adopted, because adoption is actually different than kifalatul yatim. Adoption means you take someone and you basically erase their identity and you make them your own child.
I got into the car with a drunk driver. I don't really remember much, but I do remember waking up with the car on its side and just hurting. I ended up talking to my mom and she told me to call the advocates. Even though it was complicated and I felt guilty, there was zero judgment from them. I felt like they were always on my side and they were always doing what was best for me.
I'm Matt with the Advocates Injury Lawyers. If guilt is keeping you from getting help, just call us. We'll represent you and remind you that you deserve justice.
Right? But sponsoring an orphan or taking care of an orphan, they retain their identity, which you take care of them. The Prophet ﷺ for a long time was taking care of Zayd, who wasn't actually originally a slave, but he was his tribe was attacked and he was lost and then he got sold into slavery. So he's not originally from a slave sort of situation. But regardless, the Prophet ﷺ loved him so much he considered him his son. That gave the idea of at-tabanni. At-tabanni means I consider you my son. I call you as if I call my own son, right? And this is Zayd radiallahu anhu. Now Zayd radiallahu anhu, because he used to be a slave, he's been emancipated. He's been freed from slavery. He's now free, but the Prophet ﷺ considers him his son, and he still stays with the Prophet ﷺ and is close to him, etc. The thing here to understand is the Arabs were a very high-class society. And they had high tribe, middle tribe, low tribe, slave. They had classes of people. You know, PhD, masters, bachelors, associates, high school dropout. People have educational hierarchies. People have financial hierarchies, right? People might think, oh no, we're in a democracy, we're all equal.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what neighborhood you live in? There's projects people, and there's the suburbs people, and then there's the bling gated community people. There's classes of society, right? People used to have different quality of horse, right? Somebody's driving a donkey, somebody's driving an Arabian horse, somebody's riding a purebred. Is that still the case in the car in the parking lot? Somebody's driving a Fiat, somebody's driving a Ferrari. They start with an F, but they both end very differently. Completely different class of people, different class of ride, different class of home, different class of clothing, etc., etc., etc. Isn't that the case? There are class societies. Classes have always existed, economically at least. Well, the Arabs were very class-based and tribe-based. And even if you were a slave at any point in your life, that label stayed with you. Even if you got freed, you're still a freed slave. It's not the same thing, but if somebody was in jail and then they got out, right? So they're not a convict, they're just an ex-convict, right? But the label doesn't leave you. It was like that. It was a stigma that stayed with you. There are even pre-Islamic poets like Antara, for example, whose poetry was so good it made its way to the walls of the Kaaba, who was a freed slave. And he never escaped that label. He could never escape that label. So Zayd radiallahu anhu still carries that label in that society, in that structure. Okay. Zaynab radiallahu anha is from a very high class family. She's from the Hashim clan. She's a cousin of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And she's one of the elite families. Right? So you could think of the poorest neighborhoods in Chicago, Zayd. And the wealthiest neighborhood in Chicago, Zaynab. And the Prophet ﷺ wants to break the class divide, and he wants to make people understand that people should be able to get married regardless of their economic differences or social differences. So he recommends that Zaynab and Zayd get married. And Zaynab doesn't think it's a good idea. She doesn't think it's a good idea. And Zayd is also kind of reluctant, like, I don't think she's going to like me very much. Because I'm supposed to be qawwamuna ala nisa, like I'm supposed to be the head of the household, the caretaker, I'm the emir of the house, and she's going to say, you're the emir of my house? Like she's already up here, I'm already down here. There's no way I'll have any sort of authority over her ever. So this is going to be a very difficult situation that I'm going to be put in. But he's reluctant about it. But the Prophet ﷺ insists, right? And when the Prophet ﷺ insists, out of love of the Prophet ﷺ, it's not a religious instruction. He doesn't say, you know, Allah and his messenger have commanded you to engage. No. It's not that. As we will see when we look at the historical reports. He's just strongly insisting. But in the end, it's the Prophet ﷺ, isn't it? Like, if he's insisting, it's going to be hard to say no. There are some Sahaba who have stronger will than others. The Prophet ﷺ asked one young man to sell him his donkey. He said no. No, I'm not going to sell it to you. The Prophet is asking you to buy his donkey. No, you can't have it. Right? You wouldn't give it to him. Well, that's okay. Right? So, but in the case of Zayd and Zaynab, they cave. They're like, okay, fine, we'll get married. So they get married. Now when they get married, it's just not working out. There's just too much of a difference between them. We don't know the inside story. The reason we don't know the inside story is because it's none of our business. That's why we don't know the story. I could tell you she was high class, he was from, you know, slave clan. That's why she just couldn't handle his lower class status, or she couldn't deal with living in that kind of housing. I could make all that up. It might be entertaining for you. But is that history? No. You know why? Because we don't know. You know why we don't know? Because no one knows what happens between a husband and a wife. Except who? The husband and the wife. We don't know. All we know is it wasn't working out. That much we know. Why wasn't it working out? Do you think this is what happened? Do you think that is speculation into people's personal lives? Is that something that Islam prohibits or speaks out against? Speculation into people's personal lives? But you know what? For some reason, when it comes to the best people, the Sahaba, we're very comfortable with our speculation. Like, what must have happened? Why do you need to know what must have happened? What are you going to get? What are you going to make a chara out of that? What are you going to get out of that? If this was very important for your guidance to know exactly what went down, Allah would have recorded it. The Prophet would have told us about it. Allah and His Messenger's job is to communicate guidance. If they didn't do so, there's a reason. There's a reason. All you need to know is it wasn't working. That's all you need to know. And every other detail, just put a big none of my business sticker on your notes. Like, just look at that every day. Okay? There's a nosiness that Muslims suffer from. And they bring that nosy. They're already nosy in their own personal lives. Right? There's already nosy. So what are you doing here? How long are you here? Like, I mean, people get weird around me. That's okay. I'm used to it. I ran into somebody in the elevator. I was in another country. You're here? My first impulse was to say no. I said, yes, I am. Oh, what are you doing here? Are you in this hotel? Now I'm getting uncomfortable. What floor are you on? How long are you here? Are you going to be here tomorrow? You come here every day? Is this where you have breakfast? Oh. Okay. No, like, what are you going to do this evening? Do I know you? That's okay. People get curious. I feel like people think public, people that have a public profile or public access, like public property also. And so that's okay. But it's not just about celebrities. You go to somebody's house and like, oh, so tell me about your shoe size. Tell me about your fingerprints. Like, they want to get all this information out of you. And we think it's okay. Even within the study of our religion. It's not. It's not. So I'll stick to the facts. The facts are, the marriage wasn't working. Zayd comes to the Prophet ﷺ and says, it's not working. We're not compatible. How they're not compatible? Again, none of our business. The Prophet ﷺ now feels reluctant to tell him, get divorced. Why? Because whose recommendation was it? The Prophet's recommendation. And of course, Zaynab is from a high family. And the sociological reality, we don't know this for a fact, but there are some things we can say with some degree of confidence. When you have a high profile family, and you have a higher tribe or, you know, a prime minister or, you know, somebody who's, you know, very famous or whoever, right? An elder. When there's a divorce in that family, it's a much bigger impact. It's not just two people got divorced. Everybody's talking about it. It can make its way into the news. It can make its way into the tabloids. It can affect the political situation, you know, because they're a high tribe. Every, you know, celebrities, everything about their personal life becomes like sensational. right? So it's not like everyday people having a relationship problem. This becomes a much bigger problem when it's high profile, right? And it's much more looked down upon. That's why, you know, royal princes and princesses, et cetera, they get married, but they don't get divorced. And even if they get, they do all kinds of stuff, but they don't get divorced because it's a bad look, right? So she's from a high family. And now Zayd is insisting that he wants to get divorced. This is going to be a very bad look for her and her clan and her tribe. On top of that, it's the Prophet ﷺ who recommended this marriage. So the Prophet ﷺ is telling him, don't do it yet. Don't do it. Amsik alayka zawjak. Just don't divorce her. Now, there are multiple opinions here. Some of them very flimsy, very weak. But the strongest one that I can find, that I think is the most convincing, and we'll look at the evidences tomorrow, inshallah, is that Allah at one point revealed to the Prophet ﷺ that he's going to be marrying Zainab. Allah revealed it to him. While she was already married to Zayd, Allah revealed to him that she's going to be marrying him. Now Zayd's coming along and telling him that he's having trouble in the marriage, he wants a divorce. But the Prophet ﷺ, he could have done two things. He could have just said to the Prophet, to him, well, Allah revealed to me that I'm going to marry your current wife, so why don't you just divorce her and let's just get this over with and I'll just marry her. Because Allah has revealed that to me already, so let's, why delay? Right? But what does he do? He says, keep your wife, have taqwa of Allah, do the best you can, basically. Stay in the marriage. The question then is, if he knew that he's going to marry her, why is he telling her to, what, telling him to stay in that marriage? Again, we don't know why exactly, because Allah didn't say. Allah just said that he was hiding the true intent, meaning the true intent was Allah has revealed to him that this marriage is going to happen. He didn't want to say. Why? What I can think of, what we can speculate reasonably is, if the Prophet ﷺ says, well, divorce her because Allah has instructed me to marry her, everybody around is going to say, oh, how convenient. You told your son to divorce his wife because Allah told you to marry his wife? Huh. But he knows that there are munafiqun that take any opportunity and they're going to blow this out of proportion. And it's going to demoralize the Muslims. And it's going to be even more humiliating for Zainab and for Zayd and for him and for their families, etc., etc., etc. Like, this is going to be a huge problem. So even if Allah has already decreed that I'm going to marry her, when that happens, that happens. But I shouldn't make it look like I had a hand in expediting that. I should just tell him, just do whatever you can, stay with your wife. So it shouldn't look like it came from me. It shouldn't look like that. Right? Now the interesting thing is Allah told Zayd radiallahu anhu, don't divorce her. Amsik alayka zawjak. Explicit words in the Quran. Hold on to your wife. Who's instructing here? Who's giving the instruction? The Prophet. The Quran, this surah says, whenever Allah and His Messenger give an instruction, it is not up to a believer to have any choice. There's an ayah in this surah. I'll say that again. Whenever Allah and His Messenger give an instruction, it's not up to a believer to have any choice. Yeah? And then Allah gave Zayd instruction. The Prophet gave Zayd instruction, sorry. What did he say? Hold on to your wife. Logically, you would assume then that Zayd has no choice. He's got to stay in the marriage. In the same ayah you find, and when Zayd was done divorcing her, the Prophet told him, don't get divorced. And the next thing you know what happens? He gets divorced. How can the Prophet tell him to do something and he went and did the opposite? You know what that proves? That was not a command in Islam. That was a recommendation as a family member. That was a recommendation as someone who loves and cares. That was elderly advice, but it wasn't a religious instruction. That wasn't a religious instruction. So when he told him to hold on to his wife, he was just giving general advice, but he wasn't giving him a religious mandate. And Zayd understands the difference between when the Prophet ﷺ is commanding something as the Prophet of Allah and when he's telling him to do something as someone who loves and cares for him. And so when he disobeys that instruction, it's not a disobedience of Allah and His Messenger. It's not. So he goes ahead and gets divorced. I can't think. What was I saying? Something about Islam. Oh, yeah, the man. Okay. This is a big point of contention in the surah we're going to see. The Prophet ﷺ's concern is going to be brought up. Was his concern valid, by the way? What do you think? What people are going to talk? Is that a valid concern? Yeah. Pretty valid. One day she's married to his son, and then a few weeks later she's married to him. Right? This just looks odd. It's disturbing, people would say. People are going to make all kinds of comments. And, you know, they're the best kinds of people. You know, back in the... I can't say for sure if they were Pakistanis back then. But they were Pakistani-like people. They're like, you know, I don't have a problem with it, but some people are saying it's really disturbing. There's some people that just... some people are saying, like, there's no way to justify that. And I don't even know what to say to those people. Who are these some people? Can I meet them? No, I'll ask some people if they know some people. You don't want to make it sound like you're saying it. But there's always someone called some people, right? And you just throw this on some people and spread and spread and spread. And now even Muslims that are like, they love their messenger, sallallahu alayhi wasallam. They have honor for him. They look up to him in every way. إِنَّكَ لَعَلَى خُلُقٍ عَظِيمٍ. You have the highest character of all. And what, he married his daughter-in-law? Is that what he did? Why did he do that? Well, you know, and the surah hasn't been revealed yet. The surah hasn't come and said, I made you do it. Because the surah is going to say that. But Allah put the Prophet ﷺ in that position without even giving him that surah first. He told him that you're going to marry her. And he goes and he does it. And people are already starting to talk. And this rumor is spreading and all this stuff. And I want you to understand the intensity of the problem. Islam comes along and says, Islam is basically the higher moral ground. The Prophet ﷺ is the height of the morality and character. And Islam is speaking out against indecency and lewdness. Islam is the alternative to these other lifestyles. And the ultimate example of that is the Prophet himself, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And now there's a marriage scandal against who? The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And on top of that, let's make this even spicier, the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam had four wives. He had, at the time, four wives. Zainab became his fifth. I'll say that again. He had four wives, Zainab became his fifth, radiallahu anha. The Quran has already been revealed that you can marry up to how many? Four wives. That's what's been revealed. And now he just married his fifth. Oh, so he's got a different standard for himself? Oh, we all get to have up to four. By the way, there are reports about that ayah in Surah An-Nisa that some Sahaba had more than four wives, and the Prophet ﷺ said, whoever you can let go of that are more than four, you need to let go. You need to end those marriages because you cannot have more than four wives. And Sahaba engaged in divorces of those that were more than four. The Prophet ﷺ didn't have that problem because how many did he have? Four. Now he has a fifth. And so now people are saying, first of all, his daughter-in-law? Second of all, number five? I thought he says you have to live by the book, and the book says you can only marry four, and the rules don't apply to him? Why don't they apply to him? Some people are saying this is a little contradiction. I love those some people. Right? And now this noise is getting louder and louder and louder. Yes, Muslims are politically doing really well. Money's coming in. Right? But I want you to understand this from the hypocrite's vantage point. They're starting to create this noise. The innocent Muslims, they're starting to not have an answer for what they're saying. Let's think of it from the perspective of the wives of the Prophet ﷺ. Because they're his wives. Why did he do that? Why did he marry Zainab? They're having a thought. And then on top of that, not only did he marry Zainab, radiallahu anha, on top of that, a lot of money has come in. Right? But you know the only family whose budget didn't change? The Prophet ﷺ. They're still living the same standard. Everybody else is doing better. Except who? the Prophet ﷺ, and the wives are like, so we're, our lives are no better, and now there's even another mouth to feed? And another wife of the Prophet ﷺ? So there could be an attack on their minds. The Prophet ﷺ has his own anxiety. I'm supposed to lead these people, and they follow me through anything. And if they start questioning my integrity, how are they going to follow me? And I'm not bringing this up. I'm not saying anything about it. But they're already talking. So there's the Prophet's perspective, the vantage point. There's the Ummahatul Mu'mineen's vantage point. There's the believer's vantage point. There's the Munafiqun's vantage point. And of course, the Yehud are loving it. They're absolutely loving it. Like, this is exactly what we wanted. We wanted him to be brought down to a level where they no longer look up to him. They put him, he's taken down from his pedestal in the eyes of the Muslims. In that entire climate, we're going to see how Allah is going to comment on this entire experience. What Allah is going to address. And what's amazing to me, we're going to get into this tomorrow, but what's amazing to me about this surah, the opening of this surah, is Allah did not concern himself with what the Muslims think. Allah did not concern himself with what the kuffar are saying. Allah did not concern himself with the munafiqun. Allah did not concern himself with the mothers of the believers. He's concerned with none of them. His only concern at the very top of this surah is, Ya ayyuhan nabi ittaqillah. Prophet, whose status is high and elevated. Remember I told you status is high and elevated? The one who receives news that nobody else receives, what news did he receive? Mary Zainab. And whenever he follows what Allah has given him, his status is lowered or hired? So the fact that he married Zainab, does it lower his status or elevate his status? It elevates his status. But why was he reluctant to tell Zayd to not get a divorce? He's reluctant because he thinks people are going to bring down his status. And they're going to say bad things about him, and it's going to hurt the mission. And the Prophet ﷺ is being told, you need to stop thinking about what people are going to say completely. You need to only be you need to be only cautious and fearful of Allah and Allah alone. Ya ayyuhan nabi, ittaqillah is like saying, Prophet, stop caring about everyone else. Don't even entertain the thought of what somebody else will think. Let it all go. Let it all go completely. None of it matters. This is your new test of taqwa. There's a test of taqwa when the enemies are in the thousands and you're in the hundreds. That's a different kind of taqwa test. There's a different test of taqwa when they're offering you money and trying to compromise the message of Islam. There's a different kind of taqwa test when you're in a cave and they're standing on top of the cave, and if they just look down, you're going to get killed. That's a different kind of taqwa test. This is a different kind of taqwa test. You know what taqwa test this is? This is the fear of what people are going to say. This is not the fear of getting killed. This is not the fear of the mission being compromised. This is the fear of the commentary of people. It's a human fear. And the Prophet ﷺ felt an inclination of it, and Allah Azza wa Jal told him, never let that fear enter you. Ittaqillah. No, your taqwa means you don't get to have that feeling. You can't afford it. You're the pinnacle, you're the height of Muslim belief, of this faith. You don't get to contaminate that faith even in the least bit. You know how in Surah Abasa, Rasulullah ﷺ frowned. But he frowned at a blind person. There's nothing wrong with frowning at a blind person. No offense was done. But Allah has set such a high standard for the Prophet ﷺ, he can't even bulge his forehead in front of a blind person. The same way, he can't even have the thought, what are people going to say? Allah cannot allow that thought for the Prophet ﷺ. If you think this is controversial, I'll give you controversy. In Christianity, the role model is Jesus. Never got married. Second role model is John the Baptist. Never got married. The Catholic Church, the highest ordained spiritual guide in the Catholic Church, are the Pope. And then the cardinals and the entire hierarchy of the Catholic Church. Those people and the nuns, what happens with them? They don't get married. In the Christian faith, spirituality and sexuality are opposites. You're either a person of faith or the person of the flesh. Lust is the death of your faith. Okay? The two opposite things. The Quraysh were very open and promiscuous. The Quraysh were Las Vegas on steroids. They were crazy. Medina was a bad place. Medina was a very astaghfirullah place, if you don't know. Medina had brothels and prostitutes and all kinds of crazy stuff. It was a crazy place. Mecca was like that. It was not a conservative society. By no stretch of the imagination. Alcohol, gambling, free, you know, sexual relations, completely open. Super liberal. The Jewish tribes, they don't really have... They're more about rituals than they are about these kinds of ethics. But the Muslims brought about this teaching of decency and modesty and shame and a campaign against zina and a campaign to lower the guard the eyes and all this, the modesty campaign, right? But Muslims don't understand that our modesty is not the same as Christian modesty. Christian modesty is that the relationship between men and women itself is basically a kind of compromise of your faith. And since you can't do without it, at least you can just be monogamous. That's it. Be faithful to your wife, etc., etc. That's their whole thing. The Quran offers a very different view of sexual ethics and the relationship between men and women. The Prophet ﷺ, or the Arabs, were okay, completely marrying more than one woman, completely, perfectly okay. Divorce is not the end of the world. You know, in Catholic religion, you can't even get divorced. You can only get a marriage annulled. There's no such thing as divorce. Okay? A marriage annulled means the nikah was batil to begin with. You have to prove it was never a valid marriage. Oh, I didn't realize she's my sister. They have to prove that and then they get... or they have to prove that she's already married or something. Some crazy accusation. That's the only way the king can get rid of the queen. That's how they do it. That's why they had all these illegitimate relationships. Because they don't have that. Islam came and it brought four or five things. I'm going to list them to you. That revolutionized marriage itself. How the world saw marriage before Islam. And what the Quran brought. What Islam brought. How it saw after it. Okay. One. Allah made marriage easy. There was no require. There's no high requirements. Number two, it gave men exclusive financial responsibility over the wife and the children. Women aren't financially responsible. Men are exclusively financially responsible for the wife and the children. Three, the Quran made divorce through a process easy. Follow the process and you can get divorced. And the Quran never talked about why you should get divorced. The Quran just talked about how you should get divorced. So the divorce, by the way, was either it was too... There wasn't even a process and you could just throw someone out. Or you can never get divorced. It's the worst thing ever. What three things did I list so far? What was made easy? Marriage was made easy. So now the whole tribe doesn't have to have this approval or that approval and... You know, we have to have this ceremony. No, just sneak, you know, ijab and qubul, khalas, goodbye. You can get married at a Dunkin' Donuts in Islam. It's still valid. So long as it meets the conditions, it's valid. Right? What's the second? Finance becomes the man's responsibility over the wife and the children. Three. Divorce with a process. It was given a process and it was made easy. It was given a process and it was made easy. Or remarriage was made easy. Remarriage was made easy. Because you know, in the previous world, in higher society, when a woman is divorced, she is forever what? She's cursed. Don't even invite her to a wedding because she'll probably infect other women with divorce. Right? This is Jahiliyyah society. Also in Muslim countries nowadays. What Islam came to change? The Prophet ﷺ, with the exception of Aisha, married mostly divorced or widowed women. So it completely normal to get divorced, completely normal to get remarried. It took the taboo away. It took the, and marrying more than one, taking responsibility for them, normalized. It was already normal, but it was legitimized. It was given the religious sanction. You can have more than one. So long as you give them their rights, here's, you know, there's two kinds of rights. There's qualitative rights and there's quantitative rights. There's love and affection and smiles and da da da. There's the feeling or meaningful conversations. You can't ever be equal in that. Like, you can't even have the two equal level conversations between two of your kids. It's never going to happen, right? You can't have two equal level conversations between a mom and a dad. Not going to happen. But time, finances, like, can you give each one their rights as what they deserve? That is, you know, you have to give rights. So that's the adil. If you could do that, normalized. Right? Now, what did we do? Muslims. Forget non-Muslims. Forget about them. What did we do? We came along and we said, marriage is too easy. We should make it a little harder. We should make it more expensive. We should put more requirements. We should especially make it more difficult for girls. Right? And if they're already divorced, then inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un. And of course, then on top of that, we shouldn't allow a divorce to ever happen because it's the worst, it's worse than death. Right? Fathers will tell their daughters in the Muslim world now, the only way you're coming back here is in your box. Right? With your kafan on. Otherwise, don't come back here. So we made marriage difficult. Then we made what? Divorce difficult. Then what's the third thing? No. Financial responsibility. Who is the man financially responsible for? Wife and children. No. Make the man financially responsible for parents, cousins, uncles, cousins, barbers, friends, dog. And money goes everywhere else except it doesn't go where? Wife and the kid. Doesn't go there. Okay? Parents will say it's ours. And then the fourth was what? Remarriage. Oh, forget it. Last year she was married to his best friend and she got divorced. Now she's married to him. Oh, these women nowadays. Oh, got a colorful personality. The Prophet ﷺ was put in the most controversial situation. Someone who's allegedly his own son, and he's marrying his alleged daughter-in-law, right? Why? Because Allah wanted to make clear, if it's halal, haram. You can marry whoever you want. There is no, she was married to the older brother, and then he died, and she married the younger brother. She did this, and he did this. No, no. Or she's so young, he's so old. Or he's so young, she's so... No. Are they adults? Is it halal? That's it. Goodbye. Goodbye. There's no tongues. There's no mouth running. The Prophet ﷺ was put in the front line of people making comments. Front line. He had to hear the comments from all of society about this marriage. Why? Because Allah wanted him to be the, just like he has to be in the front of the battlefield, right? He's in the front of this battlefield, taking all the arrows of people's mouths so that he breaks something. If he can take it, anybody can take it. If it's halal, it's not a problem. If it's halal, it's not a problem. If Allah made the fifth one halal for him, and he didn't make that halal for anybody else, then he's going to do it because Allah made it halal for him. I don't care what anybody else says. If you live in a society where a second wife is haram for you, and a third wife is haram for you, and a fourth, forget, even the thought of a second wife is haram for you, right? Then let everybody be angry. It's okay. If you're not doing anything wrong, if you're not violating anybody's rights, you know, and this is between a husband and a wife, I'm not encouraging you guys to go jump off a cliff. What I am saying is, if Allah made something halal, then doesn't matter what people say. There are two, I'm going to leave you with this. There are two battles. There are two battles. One battle in Islam is to fight against the haram. Please understand this clearly. One battle in Islam is to fight against the haram. The other battle in Islam is to stand up for what is halal. You have to stand up for what is halal, because corrupt society will make haram easy, and corrupt society will look down on halal. They'll make comments about the halal. And you have to stand up for the halal and take the hits for the sake of the halal. And the first one who took those hits was Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wasallam. This marriage represents the breaking of all the taboos people create that have no basis in this deen. If Allah has no problem with it, then nobody can run their mouth. ذَلِكُمْ قَوْلُكُمْ بِأَفْوَاهِكُمْ وَاللَّهُ يَقُولُ الْحَقِّ وَهُوَ يَهْدِ السَّبِيلِ. That's what this marriage actually represents. That's what the wisdom of this marriage is. And we're going to dive deep into this, the incident and what we can pick out from it. But the first, the most important thing you need to take from it is how the Quran challenged social ignorance. What are people going to say? People are going to talk. And by the way, who are those people? Do you know who they are? No one knows. But everyone's afraid of them. You know who they are? You. And you, and you, and you. And everybody's afraid of everybody else's mouth. And you know what? That's when you're afraid of people's mouths, that's when you can only have one fear in your heart. Either you have the fear of Allah in your heart, or you have the fear of the people's mouths in your heart. Allah did not give you how many hearts? Two hearts. You can have one heart for the people's fear, one heart for Allah's fear. مَا جَعَلَ اللَّهُ لِرَجُلٍ مِنْ قَلْبَيْنِ فِي جَوْفِهِ. Allah did not put two hearts inside of any man. And the first of that, the frontier of that battle is fought by the Prophet himself, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. That's why he's told, Ya ayyuhan nabi, ittaqillah. This will not reduce your status. It only elevates your status. They're liberating society from the chains that bind them down. وَيَضَعُ عَنْهُمْ إِصْرَهُمْ وَالْأَغْلَالَ الَّتِي كَانَتْ عَلَيْهِمْ. Syrian refugees, flood refugees, Rohingya refugees, earthquake refugees, right? And you have refugees in, let's say, American, you know, America, it's illegal to even have more than one wife or whatever. But imagine refugee communities, right? And all their husbands have died in war zones, etc. And they have children. And there are men that are capable and want to marry more than one, but it's been made haram for them culturally. What's going to happen to those women? Nobody will fulfill their right. Those children will not have a father figure. Nobody will take care of them. Crime will increase. Losing the faith will increase. Corruption will increase in society. Desperation will increase in society. All why? Because we didn't stand up for something halal. When you, by the way, every time you close one door to halal, any door to halal, every time you close it, what opens? Doors to haram open. Guaranteed. Every time you close a door to any halal, it will open multiple doors to other harams. Then you only get to blame yourself for closing the door to the halal. That's the reality of it. Rasulullah is being told, marriage in Islam is beautiful. It's fluid, it's open, it's in a sense very liberal. You can marry whoever, there's no class restriction. If it doesn't work out, that's okay. There's no till death do us part. That's okay. So long as we can be good to each other, so long as we can hold up the taqwa of Allah, I can be a good husband to you, you can be a good wife to me, we should stay together. If we're not able to do that anymore, what's my mother going to say? What's my father going to say? What's my uncle going to say? What's going to happen to the kids? What's going to happen to... Hold on a second. What's going to happen to the kids? Who's more concerned about the kids? You or Allah? Like, Allah's not concerned about the kids? We'll talk about that too. How does Allah protect kids in a divorce? We have to talk about that too. It'll come. Because Allah never allows something that creates fitna. Allah only allows yuhillu lahumut tayyibat. Allah only makes things halal that are good and pure. Wa yuharrimu alayhimul khabaith. He only makes things haram that are filthy inherently. So when you close a door to halal, you are opening the door to filth. You're creating filth in society. It's our lack of understanding of the halal that we run away from it so quickly, and we create a new set of rules, boxes, that society creates for us. Now Muslims live in more boxes made by people than ever made by Allah. We live in cage societies. We live in cage societies. That's the truth of it. And Allah is going to call those cultural standards what they are. Running your mouth. That's all it is. ذَلِكُمْ قَوْلُكُمْ بِأَفْوَاهِكُمْ. These are just words that just come out of your mouths. That's all they are. Literally, that's what he says.
I got into the car with a drunk driver. I don't really remember much, but I do remember waking up with the car on its side and just hurting. I ended up talking to my mom and she told me to call the advocates. Even though it was complicated and I felt guilty, there was zero judgment from them. I felt like they were always on my side and they were always doing what was best for me.
I'm Matt with the Advocates Injury Lawyers. If guilt is keeping you from getting help, just call us. We'll represent you and remind you that you deserve justice.